Our next speaker is Mitch Mallory, discussing how a poor reading of Revelation has affected American political and ecological discourse. Mitch is a master's student at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, studying Cyril of Alexandria and the Synoptic Gospels.
Thank you, Lynn, for that introduction. I wanted to begin by saying that an old professor of mine once told me that the quickest way to make money in theology was by looking for a passage in the book of Revelation that was kind of obscure, and then from that you would then develop an idea to correlate that idea with, a contemporary event or person. The masses would flock and the book would be a bestseller. So I looked through the book of Revelation and I came across a passage about a trumpet that would be sounded to inaugurate the final events leading up to the return of Christ. And then I had an idea. What if I argued that the trumpet of Revelation was in fact our very own Donald Trump? Now, I'm not encouraging people to go out and actually write this book, but it would actually make a tremendous amount of money. Anyways, I think that it's late in the afternoon, and I recognize that it's half past nap time, so I'm tempted to say, you know, sweet dreams, but I think I can keep some of you awake. If you've read the abstract of this paper, you know that I've bitten off far more than I can chew, drawing a line from dispensationalism to Donald Trump and hoping to offer a better alternative at the end. And we've only got 20 minutes, so I'm going to jump right in. One central thesis of this paper is that a particular reading of the Bible, one that draws heavily on the book of Revelation, has been a major factor in making both the United States and a large majority of American evangelicals agnostic at best and hostile at worst to addressing the climate crisis that we all face. In order to defend this claim, we need to first explore some of the central tenets of dispensationalism. We'll then go on to explore how these ideas have shaped American political culture and discourse, and after that, we'll finally offer a very brief alternative reading of Revelation. So what is dispensationalism? The millions of Americans who believe that we are living in the last days are mostly influenced by a relatively recent teaching, which is dispensationalism, an interpretive grid through which we attempt to understand the Bible's prophecies in both the Old and the New Testaments. This belief system began in Great Britain with the theological musings of John Nelson Darby in the 1830s. Darby, a former Anglican priest, was exceedingly interested in biblical prophecy, and what grew out of this interest was Darby's proposal that history was divided into different ages or dispensations, and that God's commands and humanity's subsequent responsibilities changed with each coming dispensation. C.I. Scofield was the most influential popularizer of Darby's beliefs in the United States, and he described a dispensation as follows. These periods are marked off in Scripture by some change in God's method of dealing with mankind in respect to two questions, sin and of man's responsibility. Each of the dispensations may be regarded as a new test of the natural man, and each ends with judgment, marking his utter failure in every dispensation. Following Scofield, most dispensationalists would posit that there are about seven distinct dispensations witnessed to in the biblical text, though others, you know, there's a little bit of controversy between three and eight. For convenience, I've chosen the traditional seven as seen here. More or less, the aim of dispensationalists is to read the Bible as literally as possible, but I say that word cautiously because that is not there's not really true consistency on that point. But this literal or plain reading of the text is accompanied by their end goal of concordance or correspondence between the text and the world in which we live. In other words, they seek to decode the text to find prophetic correlations between the events described in the Bible with specific events or people that would arise thousands of years later. In a way, Revelation is understood by them to be history written in advance. This becomes most prominent in the final three dispensations as seen over here on the whiteboard. I'll just be very brief. Couldn't really make a chart of some of these things. They move from the dispensation of the law, which is basically Jesus' life through his crucifixion. And then the period of grace is basically, I marked it out wrong there, resurrection through the basically, let me see here. Law goes through Paul, I guess, and then the grace period goes from basically the age of the church, and then we move into the millennium, which is, you know, after the rapture, then the tribulation. We have the second coming, the last final battle between good and evil, and all of these things. Sometimes it's hard to describe, so that's going to be a constant reference point for you right there throughout the remainder. All right, that's so. If you really want to see a chart that you maybe understand in more detail, you can look at this one right here. Despite all of these convoluted charts and arbitrary attempts to divide history into various dispensations, there's actually a legitimate reason at the core of the entire project, even if I believe they have used this important insight and drawn inappropriate conclusions. And that is that they draw a distinction between God's promises to Israel and the church. In short, dispensationalists were forced to conclude that a majority of the prophecies in Scripture are related to Israel, not the church. This is due to their understanding that the prophecy of the Messiah's expected return in the book of Daniel was ultimately postponed because the Jews rejected their Messiah. God therefore turned to the Gentiles to establish a heavenly people, putting the prophetic timeline on pause. And therefore, the 70th week of Daniel, with all of the chaos that would ensue in the millennial period, is a time of terror where the temple is rebuilt, would not begin so long as the church remains on earth. God must first remove the church before the 70th week of Daniel's prophecy so that God can then proceed and complete his plans for Israel. There are, of course, nuances and disagreements amongst this theological tradition, but at the heart of the dispensational vision lies a belief in a coming thousand-year reign of peace on earth inaugurated by Christ and his church. For premillennialists in particular, this period of flourishing would be preceded by an unprecedented amount of sin, natural disasters, persecution, and war, the 70th week of Daniel's vision. This age of terror was referred to as the Great Tribulation, a seven-year period in which an authoritarian figure, the Antichrist, would rise up and ultimately bring about the last great battle between good and evil, Armageddon. This age of suffering did not give dispensationalists a moment of pause, however. Their prophetic timeline actually gave them hope, because they would be raptured out of the earth before the crap hit the fan. So if God's purposes with Israel were to go forward, the church would have to be gone and spared from the reign of the Antichrist and God's judgment on the apostate nations who failed to confess Jesus as Lord. The task set before me now is to draw a line from dispensationalism to Donald Trump and show how this belief system has affected American politics in general and then climate change in particular. So let's look at U.S. politics. One central idea of the dispensational approach to history and eschatology was that prior to any of these prophetic events taking place, a restored Jewish nation in the Holy Land would need to be established. Without a renewed Israel, there could be no rebuilt temple, no Antichrist, no Great Tribulation, no Armageddon, and no Second Coming. In short, everything hinged upon the Jews. But how did this fringe movement garner such wide support? After bringing dispensationalism to America through a speaking tour in the 1870s, Darby originally found little support. By 1919, of 236 mainline seminary professors surveyed, only seven identified as a premillennial dispensationalist. Though the academy was difficult to convince, some pastors began to buy into Darby's message. During the tumultuous period following the Civil War, Darby began to find some support. As the church was being faced with perceived threats, from Darwin's theory of evolution to the liberal higher criticism in biblical scholarship, a trans-denominational evangelical force came together to end the spread of liberalism, which had supposedly undermined the faith. Though Darby's ideas were outside the typical evangelical orthodoxy, he became an ally because he was an enemy of their enemy, the modern liberals who were attacking the Bible. Another aid to Darby's message was the sociological reality that apocalyptic movements often spur up after times of crisis. So we're just following the Civil War, and interest in prophecy increased all across the country. Conferences started popping up in America, and one in particular, the Niagara Bible Conference, became a breeding ground for Darby's ideas. For 2 weeks every summer, dispensationalists would gather together and interpret and pour through the prophetic texts of Scripture to demonstrate their fit with the dispensational paradigm. The rise of the Bible College movement was also a major impetus in the spreading of dispensationalism. Because the Bible colleges were reacting against the historical critical biblical scholarship, they found a common ground with Darby's appeal to biblical literalism. A defining moment of the dispensational project came in 1908 with the publication of the Scofield Reference Bible, which was hailed as the supreme text committed to this belief system. Combined with the outbreak of World War I on the one hand, and the subsequent waning theological support for post-millennialism on the other, which is the idea that the millennium would precede the rapture of the church, dispensationalism began to receive an increasing amount of support throughout a new subdivision of evangelicalism in this country. Now, to the surprise of some in the academy, this fringe movement started to gain support rapidly at the outbreak of World War I. Dispensationalists had been prophesying about a coming worldwide conflict. A coming worldwide conflict that would involve both Germany and Russia since the late 1800s. While we now know that World War I was not the prelude to the return of Christ, the claims made about a worldwide conflict at the Niagara Bible Conference did precede the outbreak of the war by almost two decades. Now, I can understand how this could serve as a potentially impressive insight for those already convinced of dispensationalism. Now, the apparent success of their prophetic timeline thus led to further engagement by dispensationalists with unfolding history. They began attempts to decode and read the sign of the times during and after the First World War. That being said, their prophetic forecasts were often sometimes quite inaccurate in the 1920s and 30s. While this may sound strange, some dispensationalists actually fought against prohibition, because drunkenness was a sign of the end times, and if you take alcohol away from the people, then Jesus won't come back. So despite all of their wild predictions and claims that did not come to fruition, this did not significantly harm the movement. The mere fact that the world was in chaos was all that was needed to excite their base. Christ must surely be coming soon with all the wars and rumors of wars. Now, dispensationalism did gain some political teeth, however, as adherents began focusing their attention on the Zionist movement in Europe. Though it was primarily a secular call for Jewish statehood amidst rampant anti-Semitism throughout Europe, dispensationalists soon realized that this fit their prophetic timeline in a rather profound way. In fact, because the renewed Jewish state in the Holy Land was so central to the entire sequence of end-time events, dispensationalists were often more eager for a Jewish statehood than most Reformed Jews in the United States. It was here that dispensationalism underwent a significant turning point in their short history. Following the establishment of Israel in 1947 and the Six-Day War of 1967, Jerusalem finally came completely under the control of Jews for the first time in more than 2,000 years. This event caused many dispensationalists to change from mere observers of the unfolding events of history to active participants seeking to bring about the end through their own efforts. The primary way in which they began to actively promote the return of Christ came in the 1980s with the rise of the Christian right in the United States. Combined with pro-Israel lobbying groups, dispensationalists began promoting the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem, the last step they needed before the return of Christ. These lobbying efforts soon turned into political campaigns by many self-avowed dispensationalists. The U.S. Congress quickly became filled with Christians who had or were raised with a dispensational view of history and eschatology. Their presence in Congress is one of the main reasons why, since 1948, Israel has become the largest recipient of U.S. foreign assistance, receiving $121 billion, almost all of which has been used for arming Israel's military. In 2015 alone, the U.S. gave Israel $3.1 billion. And this is where dispensationalism's effect on climate change policy begins to come into the picture. While the popularity of dispensationalism has been on the decline since the 1990s, the general escapist view of eschatology, where the ultimate goal is to leave the earth and enter into an ethereal heaven, has not. The side effects of rapture theology in American culture, in particular the evangelical eschatology, are still affecting us. Subconsciously, these ideas still affect the way we live in this world, because our understanding of the end necessarily shapes the way that we think about the present. And with the syncretism of Christianity with the Republican Party in the 1980s, our elected officials began to craft policy informed by, whether they knew it consciously or not, these general ideas about the end of the world. One helpful but disheartening quotation will summarize this predicament. D.L. Moody, of whom Moody Bible Institute was named, once asked why we would polish the brass on a sinking ship. In other words, because we know that the world is going to end with one giant battle of Armageddon, followed by the earth being destroyed, why would we ever spend time taking care of the planet and the most vulnerable among us? If the only thing that matters is going to heaven when we die, whether via a pre-tribulational rapture or something else, preserving the earth and everything in it is ultimately not worth our time and effort. Within the realm of government, this has led to a complacency toward climate science within the right end of the political spectrum. While Congress is no longer filled with ardent dispensationalists, the effects of dispensationalism on American evangelical theology has led to minimal interest from the Christian constituents of these elected officials. And because their base shows little desire to preserve the planet, partially due to the side effects of the escapist eschatology of a bygone era, many elected officials in this country do not feel the pressure to act on these matters and are content to reaping the benefits of a large campaign contributions from the fossil fuel industry. This is why, unfortunately, there's not more Christian outrage at the periodic tweet from our commander-in-chief when he declares that climate change is a hoax invented by China in order to weaken American industry. This is why there's not more Christian outrage at how America is the only major country on Earth to pull out of the Paris Climate Accord. Now, in the short amount of time that remains, I would like to call into question this approach to eschatology and ethics by appeal to Revelation 18, casting it in dialogue with the political and economic decision-making of our current president. So this section is titled Alternative Ethics, Not Alternative Facts. The beginning of Revelation reveals that it is a circular letter addressed to seven different churches, each of which were struggling to be faithful to God amidst the demands of the Roman Empire. Christ addresses these seven churches through John in order to call them to remain faithful until the end, such that they will be conquerors with Christ. This idea of conquering with Christ and the way that it is done is not explained until chapters 4 and 5, and there's some tension that goes on in the text. And that is when John is given a glimpse into the heavenly throne room scene. These two chapters are the heart of Revelation, giving us a glimpse into exactly who God is and what it means to be faithful to this God. Now, chapter 4 is all about the eternality and worthiness of God who sits on the throne to receive worship, glory, honor, and praise. But conflict arises at the outset of chapter 5, when no one is found to be able to open the seal of the scroll. Now, John is told by someone that only the Lion of the tribe of Judah, according to the Messianic expectations of Second Temple Judaism, would be able to open the seal. But what he saw was different from what he heard. Instead, there, sitting next to God on his throne, was a lamb, standing as if it had been slain. And the reader quickly realizes that it is this slaughtered but living lamb, symbolizing the crucified and risen Jesus, that who is able to open the scroll of God's grace and is thus also worthy of the same worship, glory, honor, and praise attributed to God. This insight is central to what it means to conquer with Christ in the book of Revelation. Rather than the militarized imagery of a lion coming from the tribe of Judah to conquer God's enemies, we are given a glimpse of what it truly means to follow Jesus. Power is exemplified through surrender, justice through forgiveness, and victory through self-sacrificial death. With this in mind, let us fast forward to chapter 18. This is worth quoting at length. "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. It has become a dwelling place of demons, a haunt of every foul and hateful beast. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. And the merchants of the earth have grown rich from the power of her luxury. Then I heard another voice from heaven saying, 'Come out of her, my people, so that you do not partake in her sins, and so that you do not share in her plagues. For her sins are heaped high as heaven. And the kings of the earth who committed fornication and lived in luxury with her will weep and wail over her when they see the smoke of her burning. They will stand far off in fear of her torment. And the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn for her, since no one buys their cargo anymore, cargo of gold, silver, jewels, and pearls. The fruit for which your soul longed has gone from you, and all your dainties and your splendor are lost to you, never to be found again. The merchants of these wares, who gained wealth from her, will stand far off, in fear of her torment, weeping and mourning aloud. Alas, alas, the great city, clothed in fine linen, in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold, with jewels and pearls, for in 1 hour, all this wealth has been laid waste. I love that passage. And just so we clear things up, this is not about the end of the world, but it's about the end of empire and injustice. The end of those who create peace through the fear of military conflict. The end of those who exploit the powerless and profit from the vulnerable. The end of those who call for America first and turn away refugees. And the end of those who profit from the fossil fuel industry and remain silent and complicit in the face of climate disaster. The essence of Revelation is about conquering with Christ. And this necessarily includes forsaking the false idol of power and wealth that is Babylon, Rome, and America. And whether or not you agree with the line I've drawn historically from dispensationalism to our current political climate, Revelation is clear. God is on the side of the powerless, the vulnerable, and the disenfranchised. And according to the Bible, this includes not just humanity, but the creation that is currently groaning, awaiting its coming redemption as well. Babylon must fall so that God's kingdom and climate may flourish. Thank you. Want me to respond to the Dead Sea Scrolls? Yeah, so part of Second Temple Jewish...
Yes,
so he was asking about how the Dead Sea Scrolls used certain ancient texts to refer to events that would happen in their own historical context. And we see this in various apocalyptic texts as well. Now, at the heart of Second Temple Jewish biblical interpretation is that where Paul, a rabbinic interpreter of the Bible, is able to come in and look at Jesus and know that this is the definitive revelation of God, and then retroactively look back into the Old Testament and find places where Christ was not originally discussed, but is now understood to be present. And I think that kind of analogy, rather than correspondence, is really important here, because I think there's a distinction. Dispensationalists try to draw a correspondence between the events described in the book of Revelation with events that will happen in the future. I think at the heart of Second Temple Jewish interpretation, we can draw analogies and say, hey, here's Babylon. It's obviously talking about Rome. Babylon is no longer an empire. But whoever, Babylon, just pretend they have a hat. If you can take that hat and it fits someone else, they have to wear that cap as well. It's analogous, but it's not the exact same correspondence. All right, and so I think America fits the cap. You know, I think it fits the bill right now, and I think that drawing that analogy is different than saying it was prophesying about America, if that makes sense. Right here.
I haven't read much about Newton directly, but I understand Isaac Newton wrote more about theology than he did about, you know, science, and a lot of it was really kind of going into prophecy and trying to figure that out like that. I wonder if you've ever thought about pre-Darbyist sort of, you know, sort of Enlightenment encouraged sort of views of reading scripture that may go back before you.
Yeah, I mean, we honestly see some of these ideas to a lesser extent. Oh, to repeat the question, he was asking about pre-modern Enlightenment dispensationalism and understanding how we can use prophecy in a Newtonian sense. I wish I could explain it better than that. But in my experience, we see this even in the ancient church, but to a lesser extent. We are captivated. It's something just fundamental to the way that we live in the world, that we just want to know the future. And to say that there are examples of this in history, I would not say is then, the word I'm looking for, is then calling for us to repeat those things. Like Newton, I consider him probably Arian Christology, I imagine, pretty maybe possibly deistic. And so I wouldn't necessarily look to him as an example for how we would approach history and prophecy today. Any other questions right here?
I know a number of people who wouldn't call themselves dispensationalists at all, partly because of what Scofield wrote about miracles. But they do believe in the Israel, fulfilling these prophecies. So would you say that was, came about influenced by dispensationalism, or where, what did people view about Israel and prophecies before Darby and these people?
Yeah, I mean, Luther had lots of interactions with, to repeat the question, sorry, he was asking about how, can you just give me a little bit real quick?
Well, the main thing was that I know people who believe in
Israel. Israel, yeah, and if there's anything prior to, dispensationalism. And I would say that, Luther has, his anti-Semitism in some of his later writings kind of shaped Protestant discourse on Israel, where the church kind of was supersessionist in a way, but knew at the same time that if God's promises changed and he had replaced Israel with the church, that would be a problem. And that was a pre-dispensational conviction. People held to that, and so they needed to hold on to, and I hold on to that, God's promises to Israel will be fulfilled, but I don't think we're on a prophetic timeline that's put on pause temporarily in the 70th week of Revelation. And so I do believe that those ideas precede dispensationalism, but I think people who hold on to them still would fall into the category of those who have, I guess I should say it this way, a good theology seeps into a culture, and people aren't necessarily aware of what those ideas are, and then it's just ingrained into the way that they think subconsciously. And I'm not saying that dispensationalism is good, but it has been successful at seeping its way into just fundamental way that we live and move in the world. And honestly, I think it has shaped our culture, like beyond this, beyond our politics, and beyond climate change in many, many more ways than we could possibly fathom.
Okay. All right.
Any one more? Right here?
Yeah, one quick one. Yeah.
Why do you think that dispensationalism and dispensational premillennialism has led to this attitude of, why polish the brass on a sinking ship when, some of the other eschatological camps that still have, at some point, Christ will come and we'll end up in a final state that this world is finite, why that has not led to so much of this attitude of...
So can you clarify briefly, why are people, what's the why question of that?
The why is, why has dispensationalism led to this attitude of why polish the brass on a ship when the other eschatological views have not?
Yeah, so her question was, why has dispensationalism contributed so strongly to the notion, why polish the brass on a sinking ship, which was D.L. Moody's quotation from earlier. I believe that based on just rapture in and of itself is probably one of the biggest reasons that I can put my finger on and say this idea about our future as an escape from this earth rather than Revelation 21's vision of heaven coming down to earth with the making new of all things and the resurrection of the dead, this very bodily view of future salvation is completely lost when we focus on rapture to an ethereal heavenly state somewhere else. And so I think very psychologically, we're going to hear a talk on secular eschatology, partly secular eschatology is coming up next. It's the way that we think about things and how they will end, the way that we think about our future and the way that things will be, will inevitably shape the way that we function economically in the present and the way that we address things like healthcare and things like that. So the end shapes the present far more than we realize. And I think that happens in theology and elsewhere. Cool. Thank you.
Thank you, Mitch.